It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Okay, thank you for tuning in once again to the It's Going Down podcast. We are lucky enough today to have some guests from the Earth First Journal. The Earth First Journal is a longstanding radical ecological publication that's come out for several decades. It covers environmental, ecological, anarchist, native struggles across the world. You can buy a subscription. It still comes out in print. They also have the Earth First Newswire, which is a fantastic resource. So let's just get started. Can you all introduce yourselves?
Yeah, thanks for having us. I'm Viri, and yeah, I work here at the Journal.
Hey, and I am Onion, and like Viri, I also work at the Journal.
Okay, and we're going to be talking about the Earth First has a crowdfunding campaign now. You're moving the office, and you know, we're going to be talking about the campaign, we're going to be talking about Earth First, we're going to be talking about radical ecological direct action struggles, but also just, you know, what is it like to run like a radical business, you know, all that stuff that gets thrown into that. So just for those that don't know, to get us started, what is Earth First? Can we trace the history of the movement itself?
So Earth First, as you kind of touched on, is a radical environmental movement, started around late 1979 or early 1980, kind of in response to people at that time feeling like more mainstream groups, nonprofits, were making a lot of compromises when it came to environmental defense, saying like, if you preserve this part of the forest, then you can cut this part, or they're just really interested in saving a specific area and they're throwing other areas under the bus. It was founded with that idea of never compromising with corporations that are destroying the earth and using direct action to defend those places rather than appealing to state powers or to the corporations themselves. Yeah, also based on the idea of biocentrism, like not using sort of like economic arguments to defend these wild spaces, just saying they exist for their own purposes and should continue to exist. And it's changed a lot over time. I think it's, you know, there's a lot of anarchists in Earth First now. It's gotten more intersectional and a little bit broader. I think it's all over the world now.
And in my opinion, it's also almost like a family, you know. We have gatherings twice a year, and you start to see the same people over and over again for years who are doing the same things that you're doing and have the same passions, and that builds networks, you know. Like, whoop, whoop. I know that as an Earth Firster, I could pretty much travel anywhere in the country and most of the world and have somewhere to stay just because I'm an Earth Firster.
I said whoop whoop. I don't think you heard me. That was a juggle over.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to mention that similar to something like Food Not Bombs, Earth First is sort of just a banner that people organize under who have a similar set of beliefs. So there's no hierarchical structure that you have to appeal to start calling yourself an Earth First group. You can just say, I think that this area that's being threatened needs to exist. I'm going to go out there and defend it. I am fill in the blank Earth First group, you know?
Right. How did the Journal get started?
The journal started shortly after Earth First did, and it was kind of just out of somebody's house. So, you know, like the person's home address was in the first few issues and their home phone number. And it was before the internet was widely used. And it started out as a newsletter. And over the past almost 40 years, it's gone like a newsletter, a magazine, a newspaper, back to a magazine. Now we're in regular magazine format. There was times where it came out monthly. There were times where a whole year went by and it didn't come out. And then now we're back to like 4 issues per year. We have short-termers and long-termers and volunteers who work here. A volunteer can just come through and get a free place to stay in exchange for yard work or helping out with the journal. Short-termers make a little bit more of a commitment. They agree to stay between 3 and 6 months, and they get a small stipend, and they also get free rent and things like that and have a little bit more responsibilities than volunteers. And then there's long-termers who agree to stay on average between 2 and 4 years, but often it's longer because you're waiting for someone to replace you. And they make very, very slightly more money and have to put, like, you know, their name on the bank account and their name on the business and things like that.
So I'm actually kind of, like, curious to talk a little bit about that. I mean, obviously not about people's names or whatever, but, like, just how that all works. Because, I mean, you know, it's a radical project, but it's also a functioning business. I mean, and I think, you know, all anarchist revolutionary media projects, like, you know, have to deal with this. Like, you know, if you want to be a critical piece of infrastructure, you obviously need money. You know, you need to spend a lot of time on this. But so speaking for the journal, as you said, it's a functioning journal and a website. People are working on it. They're getting money. They're getting a place to stay. So how do you all make that work? I mean, also you've got like people coming in. So you've got to like kind of like teach them the ropes. I mean, how do you do that?
It's not easy. I mean, I think it's confusing, you know, because you're like, I'm an anarchist, fuck capitalism, fuck making a profit, all that stuff. And then in order to come out with a magazine, we have to make a profit, you know, because we have to pay for printing, we have to pay for shipping, we have to eat, we have to pay rent in the house that we live in. And so it's just trying to find a balance, and donations help, you know, like if we were relying completely on subscriptions, then we'd have to hustle like capitalists and we'd have to like go out there and sell. But because we have a few people who give us a good amount of money every year, and we have a lot of people who give us smaller amounts of money, and that helps us to get by without having to rely on selling out as much as we.
Yeah. And I think, also just getting submissions from people is a huge part of what keeps us afloat. Like, people giving us money when they can is obviously super important, but when there's been times when we haven't gotten as many submissions for the journal itself, and that just leads to so much more work for us, and obviously a magazine that is not as good. So people just being involved, I mean, we always want people to like call us, write to us, whatever. If you have a campaign going on, just tell us about it however you're able so we can spread the word. And that makes people more excited about the magazine, which is good for subscriptions, but also just makes it more useful to the wider movement, I think, and makes our day-to-day stuff more fun and better.
Yeah, and I think an important thing about submissions is I think a lot of people who are, you know, doing actions and things like that, they're hesitant to submit because they're like, oh, they're professional writers and it's a magazine that's been around for 40 years. But we are editors, so we accept, as long as it's a good article about something rad, then it doesn't matter how well it's written because we can make it sound better. So we would rather receive a jumbled communique about a tree sit that we have to work on and make sound better than, you know, a 3,000 word something boring and liberal.
Right. Yeah, no, totally. We totally understand how you feel that it's going down, because I mean, we're in the same boat.
Totally.
And, you know, just to reiterate that for everybody that's listening, I mean, you know, obviously, if you look at IGD, there's a lot of stuff that gets submitted. There's a lot of stuff that gets submitted to Earth First. But I mean, again, it doesn't have to be endnotes. You know, it doesn't have to be, college paper. Just, say what happened, let people know what all went on. I mean, that's the main thing.
Yeah. And we used to have in the journal a really lively letters to the editor section, and a lot of movement debate happened there, and people just shared their opinions with us. So even that, even if it's not submitting something that's about a badass campaign, just sharing thoughts about the state of the movement or talking about environmental issues. Yeah, we haven't had a Dear Shit for Brain section in the last 3 issues because we just haven't been getting as many letters. And I think, in the past, that was a really important part of the journal where there was a lot of movement debate happening and a lot of really interesting, back and forth about stuff. And I think people email us now. I don't know if it's just sort of because people write less letters to the editors in general, but we would love to bring that back. So people should write us letters.
Yeah. And I'm sure, lots of different people would make this comment, but as things have transitioned more to the internet, less away from print, there definitely has been a lot less of, people sitting down to write kind of like a mini essay, but, write a letter and put it out there.
Yeah.
And have people read it and respond to it.
Yeah. I grew up writing letters to the editor. If I read something stupid in the newspaper, I'd write a letter, but now, I just read an article and then I commented on it on Facebook, and it's way easier than writing with a pen and paper. Who does that anymore?
Right. Right. And then you get your little snarky comment on the top. So,
your snarky comments.
Yeah. What's that?
I said people should write us long snarky comments and right. Then we can read
them. Right. So we have a joke kind of at It's Going Down, but eco is the new Antifa. But can you comment on just kind of the explosion of direct action ecological struggles happening around not only so-called North America, but around the world? But what's causing this growth?
I think right now, shit just feels super dire to people. I mean, with the election of Trump in this country, we've seen a lot of people that didn't previously think of themselves as radical, wouldn't have called themselves activists, getting out into the streets, trying to organize things, because this is just feels so immediately threatening to people. And on a wider scale with, climate change being increasingly obvious, I feel like people, just feel this immediate threat to our actual lives and the planet that maybe didn't feel so urgent to people in the past for whatever reason. And I feel like in that way, ecological struggles and anti-fascist struggles actually really go hand in hand, because white supremacy and environmental destruction are both these really huge, real threats. They're perpetuated by the same groups. Someone like Trump is really emboldening Nazis and opening up a bunch of public lands to drilling. I feel like those fights are really connected, which is part of the reason that smaller media projects like y'all and the journal feel really important at a time like this, because the way that the mainstream media covers movements like this, I think highlights them as really separate issues and things that just sort of come out of nowhere. All of a sudden people are talking about anarchists because of the J20 protests, or people are talking about blockades and various kinds of direct action in defense of the environment because of something like Standing Rock. But really, there's all these people that are organizing against all these threats all the time, continuously, So having projects like these that can show people that those things really do go together, I think, is important.
Yeah, and I think piggybacking on the whole Trump thing, I think he is a white supremacist who's openly white supremacist in office as the president of the United States. And that's made a lot of white supremacists who've been hiding under rocks for the past however many years feel comfortable with, you know, donning a KKK hood and walking down the street. And I think Trump is also one of the least environmental friendly presidents we've ever had. And all his buddies are coming out of the woodworks and, you know, just destroying things at a faster pace than we've seen in a long time. And I think it's also, you know, that's pretty negative, but the positive side is, you know, Standing Rock happened a couple years ago.
Yeah, right.
And I think that was, even for someone like me who'd been going to, you know, I've been an activist for over a decade, and going there, like, I was like, holy shit, this is the revolution. Like, it's happening. And I think that opened people's eyes up to the possibilities of what happens when we all can work together. And it also allowed people to create networks, you know, like everyone who felt passionate about this thing flocked to this one area, and you got to meet other people from all around the world who felt just as passionately as you did. And now when a pipeline springs up in your neighborhood, you know who to call and you know how to act and you know where to send your communiques and all that. So
let's talk about Standing Rock real quick. Did you both go?
No,
I went for a short time.
I'm just curious. I mean, just within Earth First, you know, broadly speaking, of course, but either, you know, both as yourselves as individuals, but also, you know, Earth First as a movement, an idea, a magazine. Just talk about the impact of Standing Rock, if you could. And just, yeah, I mean, looking back on it now, because, you know, we've heard from people that went there and just said, like, it doesn't matter if they lost here, because like what this, you know, what this led to was just the explosion of so many different encampments and projects and struggles all over.
Yeah, I think, yeah, like you said, it really empowered a lot of people to feel like they could reproduce some of these tactics in their own communities. And it also led to a lot of really important conversations. I know, like, within Earth First circles about when it's appropriate to go to someone else's struggle across the country and how to show up for that, you know, and in a way that's legitimately helpful. And, yeah, just about what tactics are effective and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we lost, they won, but it doesn't seem like that because they're still pretty pissed off and they're filing wild lawsuits, and the CEO is going in public and saying that protesters should be killed, and all this other stuff is happening as a result of Standing Rock
obviously we know about the lawsuit because we've had somebody from Earth First on to talk about that, but what about people should be killed?
He said, do you remember the exact quote?
He,
taken out of the gene pool.
This is somebody from Energy Transfer Partners?
It's the CEO.
Yeah, Kelsey Warren, at some energy conference was talking about the effects on the industry of protesters and said, like, talk about people that should be removed from the gene pool or, you know. So they're obviously upset, at least.
Right, right. Because of all the people in the world. Protesters versus CEOs. Who should go first? Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, just one other thing about, we were talking about media, but, you know, Tiger Swan released like a little kind of like their little, you know, the RAND Corporation analysis of Standing Rock protests, but they mentioned the ability of the protesters to link up to kind of like groups like the ACLU, and they also said it's going down too as well.
Yes.
So it shows that they don't want, you know, these struggles linking up with media and also groups that can provide legal infrastructure and stuff like that. So again, shows, you know, just how much media is important. But going on from what you're saying with Standing Rock, some of the struggles right now, I'm curious, that are really inspiring you that you're covering in the journal and also on the Newswire. What are some of these?
We've been covering the Matol for a while, the fight in the Matol forest in California. And that's personally inspiring to me, and I know a lot of us here, and it's been going on. The fight's been going on since before some of us were even born, and they're still fighting, you know. And then the Louis Levy camp in Louisiana trying to stop the Bayou Bridge pipeline, they're kicking ass, you know, like they're having actions constantly, and yeah, they're not backing down. And yeah, I mean, those two are probably the most exciting to me.
Yeah, I definitely would second the Matol. I think it's amazing to see some of these really long-term struggles, like the ZOD right now. These things that have been going on for years, and people start thinking about how to actually build. You know, it's like it's not just about resisting a project, but creating a space in doing so where you can live in a different, healthier way. And it's really inspiring to me. And the ways that people in the ZOD have reacted to all the oppression that they've been facing and the way that communities there have shown up for them is really amazing. And yeah, I mean, there's so many things going on, all the stuff happening in British Columbia right now with the Kinder Morgan pipeline, thousands of people marching, the Tiny House Warriors, that's an amazing project. Everything that TWAC does to me is super amazing. The Trans and Women's Action Camp, sort of a smaller group within Earth First that tries to create spaces for, I always wish there was a better way of saying this, but not cis men. And there's actually an action camp, a TWAC action camp, happening right now in North Carolina. And that is always just really amazing to me to see, because I think Earth First, increasingly, it's like a very queer, it feels very queer right now. And so it's really awesome to center that and have a space where people feel safe. And yeah, I could go on forever. Rojava, obviously, there's a million things.
Uh-huh. And some of these struggles, like, for instance, what's happening in West Virginia and Virginia right now, fighting the Atlantic Coast Pipeline and the Mountain Valley Pipeline, seem to have very large, broad public support. Is this kind of a new development that, like, these pipeline battles are getting more and more support? Is that also something that came out of Standing Rock, or is this something that's always kind of been there for environmental direct action struggles? For instance, you mentioned the Matol struggle.
Well, I think that it obviously depends on the area a lot. And I know somewhere like Northern California does have a little bit of a history of the community being at least somewhat supportive of those struggles. And I know that there are people like Judy Berry, who was an Earth Firster that was doing a lot of really amazing environmental defense in the 90s, was known for reaching out to like loggers and like working class people in the area and trying to get them involved and get their perspectives. So I think it's new in some areas, it's not in others, but it is, you can see how much more effective these fights are when there is when it's really rooted in like a sense of community and and it's like a broader, more popular movement.
And I think Standing Rock helped normalize direct action a little bit, at least for our generation. I know, like, you know, I've been doing this for a while. I've gotten arrested a few times, and my parents have been not unsupportive, but not throwing me parties when I go to jail. And when I was getting ready to leave for Standing Rock, both of my parents were just like, I can't believe this is happening. Like, why are the police acting like this? Why are they trying to build a pipeline there? And so that was a great opportunity for me to, like, teach them about, you know, this isn't rare. This happens all the time. This is just getting more attention. And now it's at the point where, yeah, I think if someone tried to build a pipeline through my mom's backyard, she might go sit in a tree or something. And another thing that I find exciting about places where people in the community are the ones who are taking to the trees and doing the direct action is that I think a lot of the reason why white supremacists are successful is because they go into poor rural areas and they organize, they help people meet their basic needs. And then once they have the trust, they tell these people like, oh, well, the reason why you're so poor is because of, you know, the white man is losing power or whatever. And we tend to not do that. We tend to just organize amongst ourselves and then wonder why nobody is joining us. And I think we're starting to learn to take cues from the people who are being affected. And the people who are being affected aren't waiting for people to come around and organize them. They're leaving their house in the morning. They're seeing construction crews chopping down the trees on their property and they're taking action.
Right. And also, tree sits have returned in a big way, or, you know, they seem more in the forefront. And I'm just curious, you know, this tactic has been around for a long time. But are we seeing new tactics added onto it, or simply a continuation of what's worked in the past? What are your thoughts?
I feel like it's not so much that people are using new tactics as, like we were saying earlier, maybe people who wouldn't have thought of themselves as people who would take this kind of action are now using these tactics. They're being used more broadly, maybe, by wider groups of people. And it does seem like we're at a place right now where it's sort of easy. I don't know if I would say easier, but it's a moment when you can get this information easily about these different actions going on. So it feels like they're happening just constantly because there is like a public sentiment is kind of on the side of people who are blocking pipelines and sitting in trees and stuff.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it still works. People are doing it because it still works. When you climb 50, 60, 100 feet high in a tree, 9 out of 10 times it still baffles the local police department and it baffles the fire department. And I don't know. I mean, it's normal, quote unquote, normal people who are kind of familiar with direct action, maybe from Standing Rock, maybe from other things that are happening. Maybe they got their hands on a direct action manual. And like I was saying before, they leave their house and they see a pipeline being built through their property and they talk to the oil company and the oil company doesn't listen and they petition their government and they don't listen and they call like Sierra Club and Sierra Club can't do anything and they're left with no choice. And the obvious thing to do seems to be to just get in the way of the machinery. And the easiest way, or the most effective way to do that, in my opinion, and their opinion, I guess, is by climbing up in a tree.
Right. We're going to turn now to the interplay between Native struggles and radical ecological anarchist direct action campaigns. But let's just talk about kind of the state of that interplay and those relationships, and also how can we make these bonds grow even deeper?
Yeah, I think in some ways it feels really obvious. Like, of course, environmentalists in this country and indigenous land defense struggles are going to coincide, because obviously there's a history in this country of indigenous people being forced onto land that the government deems undesirable and it's undeveloped, and then later they come back in and say, oh, there's uranium here, or this is a place we can build a pipeline. And so it makes sense that these would be this areas that people would want to defend for multiple reasons, and there would be connections there between those communities. And I also just think people in this country, anarchists, radical environmentalists, are realizing that everyone kind of has to reckon with the systemic racism in this country and like maybe what decolonizing would look like. You just can't have a radical movement without taking that history into account. And I know like environmentalism hasn't always been accountable to those ideas. And I think people are trying to prioritize it right now and just be better at listening to people, be better at being intersectional. And I guess that's how to make the bonds grow deeper also.
Yeah, I mean, like Fury just said, like, shut up and listen. You know, it's too often that, like, settlers or white people are going to native fights and showing up thinking they have all the answers. And in reality, they don't. And just, you know, not just showing up at a place. If people are putting out a call for help, you know, at Standing Rock, they said, hey, we need people to come here. We need bodies. So it's cool. But there's a lot of places where they have enough people, but maybe they need firewood or they need blankets or they need tents. And maybe that $500 you're going to spend to go travel out to this tree sit would be better used if you bought firewood or you bought something that they actually need. And just listening to what they say, listening to what people say. If you're trying to stand in solidarity to somebody, that doesn't mean telling them what to do.
Yeah, and I think that offering material support, if you have some relative privilege, like you were saying, too.
I think it's also been awesome to see the anarchist movement becoming, explicitly anti-colonial, too, and just its mm-hmm. language and just kind of how it sees itself.
Yeah, I think, like, if we're trying to be forward-thinking, we're trying to think about the kind of societies we want to have that aren't coercive and aren't hierarchical, like, how can we have those conversations without acknowledging that we're on stolen land, you know? Right. Like, how can we
right.
actually physically create those spaces if that's not part of the conversation?
Right.
And I think for me as an anarchist, too, like, my thought process used to be more like, oh, capitalism is the problem. If we destroy capitalism, everything else will make sense. And now my thought process has kind of changed to, if we destroy all the fucked up things, like we get rid of patriarchy, if we get rid of all that other stuff, then there is no capitalism.
You just need to destroy all the fucked up things.
Yeah, destroy all the fucked up things will be fine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also I would add, like, if you look at the history of the Americas, I mean, like, there's a reason why the Canadian state, for instance, like, wants to make nice with all the native groups and stuff like that, because they want to ram through all these infrastructure projects. You know, there's a reason why, you know, all the states and so-called, like, you know, South America are battling native groups to, like, put mega projects in place. So I think that without an anti-colonial analysis, you know, especially in, you know, the Americas, then you're not really going to understand, you know, exactly how industrial capitalism really works. Because if you're just kind of using, like, a, you know, I go to work and my boss exploits me, I mean, that's just like kind of like a really base level analysis, you know, of just mm-hmm. kind of like how, you know, the system is running itself. But you know, just turning now, as we've stated, we had somebody on the program before with Earth First that talks about that crazy lawsuit. I don't know if you all want to give an update on that. That would be great. But just for those that don't know, there was a lawsuit that it was aimed at Greenpeace and also Earth First, claimed all sorts of just batshit off the wall incendiary stuff, saying that Earth First was basically a membership movement, went to Standing Rock for the purpose of, like, selling heroin and drugs to, like, fund an eco-terrorist army. And all these just off the wall things, if you want to speak to that. But moreover, you know, in the last couple months, there's been a slew of anti-protest laws aimed at, you know, essentially pipeline campaigns. And I'm just curious if you can talk about these laws and what do they aim to do.
I guess I can answer that, and then you can talk about the law. Yeah, there's so many anti-protest laws right now, and it feels to me like part of the reason we're seeing so many of those is because of the effectiveness of things like Standing Rock and of groups like Black Lives Matter and just more informal, like, anti-police brutality protests, like movements that are led by people of color, that where there's a lot of people and they're getting out in the streets, like, and they've been effective. And there's been so many laws that seem to be targeted specifically at those types of movements or moments. And they're, like, all backed by cops. I mean, there's all these cops that are pushing to get these laws passed, like Minnesota's trying to pass this HF 390, which would have more fees and jail time if you block a highway specifically, and there's a bunch of laws like that happening, like specifically increasing penalties for blocking highways or infrastructure. North Dakota like changed the definition of rioting, increased penalties for people who like cover their faces. South Dakota said the governor could like stop gatherings of people on public land. I mean, it's all these places that have had like Minneapolis, the areas in North Dakota where Standing Rock went in, there's been like big environmental protests or big protests against police brutality and stuff. And I think in some ways it does feel new. I think like in law enforcement feels really emboldened by the Trump administration to push for these kinds of laws. And it also shows that there has, you know, they think that these things are, these movements are somewhat effective and are really challenging them. But it's also something that to some degree the environmental movement has seen in the past, and the animal rights movement, like the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act passed a few years ago, which increased penalties for people who damaged industries that like use or sell animals or animal products. And that's been used to give people a lot of really ridiculous, overinflated sentences. So I think when they feel like there is a movement that's becoming broad enough and effective enough, the government tries to scare people away from those specific tactics. You know, people are blocking highways and running onto construction sites a lot. And things that they do to make themselves feel safe when they do that, like masking up, they're just obviously trying to make people feel too afraid to do those because they seem to be working to some degree.
Yeah, and who are they applying these laws to? You know, like we were in Louisiana and we found out that it was illegal to cover your face at any time, and it was punishable by a minimum 6-month sentence in jail. And so are they pulling over people on motorcycles for wearing helmets? Are they are they going to Mardi Gras and arresting people? Are they arresting people on Halloween? Probably not. It's only being applied to who they want to apply it to. And like Vera was saying too, I think they're scared. You know, like if they were able to do whatever they want, if they were just, if there was no fighting back against what they were doing, or not effective fighting back, then I don't think they'd be doing this. They would just be counting their money and doing whatever else rich people do. But they're scared. They're losing money. They're losing power. The public opinion is turning against them, and all they have left is to make these draconian laws that to try to hold us down. But it's not going to work. Like the lawsuit, which you brought up. It's been wild, but the latest update is a good update. We got a new judge who is an interesting character, and he decided that he wanted to make it go faster. And his latest ruling was that that Earth First was not served properly because Energy Transfer Partners couldn't find anybody in Earth First to serve, so they served the Earth First Journal. So right now, Energy Transfer Partners can either drop the whole lawsuit, they can file a new lawsuit that doesn't have Earth First or the Earth First Journal in it, or they can find someone else who they think represents Earth First and try to serve them and see what happens. So I think we're just headed towards the whole lawsuit being dropped, is my opinion.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a bunch of bullshit. But what's scary about all these different laws is that, you know, I think the government is getting smarter, and that they realize that there is not, you know, this isn't the Weather Underground or, you know, some like, you know, cadre of communist guerrillas living in a safe house somewhere. It's like they're up against, you know, broad social movements that are, you know, part of human communities. And the way they're going to fight that is by, you know, criminalizing everyday actions. You know, it's like,
yeah,
if you walk on a freeway, that's already illegal.
Yeah.
Then now they're going to be like, well, it's illegal plus terrorism now, you know, so it's,
yeah,
it's extra illegal.
Extra illegal, which is hilarious because I'm sure all these people would like totally be against, you know, any sort of like hate crime legislation or like, you know, added sort of, you know, legislation against somebody that does something against, you know, a group of people. But of course, when it's against, you know, corporations or, you know, the fossil fuel industry, then then they really got to stand up and do something because, my God.
Yeah.
Their bread is buttered.
And they want to make these movements that are incredibly empowering for people too scary to join. You know, it's the same reason they use words like terrorist and stuff. They're trying to elicit this reaction that stops people from having the life-changing moments that they have when they realize that they can, like, just get together with their friends and, like, fuck shit up or create a beautiful community and resist stuff.
I think that that's something to really explore, and that we need to really kind of think about that and really, you know, wrangle with that. I mean, we've written about that a lot on IGD too, but, you know, because, like, that is, like, their only selling point is, like, you know, Antifa is going to come to your house and stab your grandma and kick your puppy, and, you know, like, yeah. That's all they have. Like, and, you know, it's so based on just kind of like the window to the right created by Alex Jones and everything else. But I don't think many people buy that, especially like when you compare it to just like what is happening with like everyday life, you know, and the positive kind of feedback that a lot of social movements are having, and the fact that, like, you know, the autonomous social movements, the grassroots social movements that exist right now are not engaging in violence against the everyday public. I mean, that's not the goal at all, to hurt people within the public. You know, if anything, it's to, like, make them excited and pull them in. So, I don't know. I think that kind of smokescreen can work with some people. But I think the majority of the population, it's just, I mean, insofar as that they even care, I don't think it's going to work.
Yeah. I mean, when all you have is fear, which is sort of the guiding principle of, like, the alt-right, or like white supremacy. Yeah, it's the whole thing is like, well, you could do that, but what if something scary happens? Or like, you could question your beliefs, but isn't that really scary? And these movements have so much more to offer people than that. They're like, come to a community where we're critical and you can be involved in making decisions and having really important conversations, you know, and it's not just like be afraid all the time. But I think you're right. People are increasingly kind of seeing that for what it is.
And I mean, that's why we're so important. Like the journal and it's going down.
we're
so great. You know, and then places like that, because they are using bullshit tactics, but they have the money and they own most of the media and things like that. Whereas we have smaller voices, but I don't know, we have truth on our side. And the more, you know, someone sits down to watch the 5 o'clock news and they see how they hear someone talk about how Antifa is violent and they're coming for you. Like you said, they're coming to stab your grandmother, but then they meet someone who, you know, is maybe helping them with something else. Right. And they're an anarchist and they're Antifa. And they're not going to stab your grandmother. In fact, they might give your grandmother a ride to the hospital if she needs one, or help her get her medicine.
Right.
And I think doing things like that, you know, you can try to spread as much lies as you want, but when you witness the truth, there's no changing your mind.
Yeah. Well, the hard part comes when they, like, actively do stuff to, like, try to give validity to what they're saying. So, for instance, with Earth First, you know, they launched the lawsuit that says they were selling heroin and, you know, then blah, 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 you know. So, I mean, they're trying to present a case where, like, that is, like, in some universe, like, realistic. I mean, just like when Politico last year published an article about anti-fascist, and it was, like, a leaked document from the FBI that said outlandish things like anti-fascist, like, firebomb Trump supporters and, you know, like, they referenced the protests in Sacramento in 2016 and implied that, like, anti-fascists were the ones that were going around stabbing people as opposed to the people that got stabbed. I mean, so on and so forth. But, I mean, you know, once that report came out, then every fusion center in the country then had had a document in their hand to point to say, like, see, you know, they're the ones causing the violence, you know, even though everything in there was bullshit and it wasn't even fact-checked, but...
Yeah.
You know, that's when it gets scary, is that, you know, everybody down to the beat level police officer, you know, thinks they have the facts, which are wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it blows my mind that they come up with the kind of accusations that they do, because they're just so exaggerated. It's not like, I mean, yeah, like you talk about with the lawsuit, it's like they just threw everything, you know? I guess it's that, like, you just see maybe one thing will stick. Maybe people will remember one part of it, and that'll make them think that Earth First is scary. But it just seems like a bizarre tactic to have such outlandish claims all the time. But, I mean, like you said, they... maybe because they're so bizarre, like, they do stick with people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if reading the lawsuit is like, I don't understand how anybody with common sense can read this and be like, oh, wow, it must be true. Right. But in reality, a lot of people, you know, a lawyer wrote that. So why would a lawyer lie? A CEO of a major corporation, he has no reason to pick on, like, little people like us. So why would they make that up? And it's so outlandish,
right,
that how can you possibly make that up and expect to get away with it?
Imagine being in that boardroom and then we'll say this. And that's, yeah, they sold drugs, and then...
Well, I think that the part where it gets really scary to me is that there are then media outlets that read something like that and they condense it, and that's when it starts to maybe sound realistic to people. It's like, right, if you went down the list of everything that they accused Earth First of in that lawsuit, I think most people would say that's absurd. But if they read a little blurb on Breitbart that just mentions that people are accusing Earth First of, you know, raising drug money, they're like, oh yeah, that's just one thing. Right. And, you know, yeah, again, like, with having more independent media projects that can counter that kind of stuff, especially with all the wacky bullshit that conservative media outlets are up to these days, yeah, it seems really important.
Right. Yeah, and, like, in the lead up to all the stuff that popped off in the Virginias, you know, like, they had an ex-Breitbart guy that was writing articles, and his line was Green Antifa. And that was kind of like what he was going with. But I mean, yeah. And again, like, did that kind of, like, media campaign from the side of the right work? Fuck no, it didn't. I mean, it's a total red state area. It's a, you know, rural area that went for Trump. But, like, those people are still out there supporting anarchists.
Yeah.
You know, like, they totally fucking lost. So fuck them. But anyway, just going forward, you know, some people might ask, we're switching gears here. Some people might ask, why do a print magazine in 2018? And I'm curious about this myself. But, I mean, your thoughts. Does it still make sense to do print, to just kind of, like, throw thousands of dollars into a magazine or a newspaper? Why is it important to still have a print publication in the age of the internet?
That's a question we get asked quite often. I think, yeah, if our intention was to start a business and make a bunch of money, then starting a magazine would definitely not be smart. But as far as, like, getting the word out, you know, there's people, a lot of people, you know, use the internet, a lot of people watch TV and stuff, but there's people in tree sits, there's people in prisons, there's travelers who just want to hold a copy of the journal. You know, like, when we have a bunch of prisoner subscribers, and when we send one magazine to one person in prison, that gets shared until it's falling apart. So they wouldn't otherwise get that news, or it would be a lot harder for them to get that news if it wasn't for the magazine. And, you know, we're banking on a crash. What happens what happens when everything just collapses? People are going to be passing around issues of the Earth First Journal
over the fire. Yeah, I think that's feels to me like the most important reason that we have a print magazine, not the collapse of civilization, but because people are in tree sits, at blockades, in the woods, and also just the fact that, you know, you could be at a protest and hand someone a copy of the journal, like, you could find a copy of the journal at some punk house somewhere and read it, and especially right now with so many people engaging in the internet through social media and being kind of in these tiny bubbles, it can be hard to break out of that and to get other kinds of information. So I think having print media that people can share outside of the internet is a really great, effective way to get people information that they wouldn't see otherwise. You know, we're like all stuck in these weird algorithms on the internet. And that's only going to get worse. There's all this talk about privatizing the internet. The journal definitely has intentions to get a little more tech savvy in the future. And I think that that part is also important. We want to continue doing the Newswire and everything, but there are just some spaces where it feels really important to have something that you can hand someone. And also with the prisoner subscriptions, it has encouraged a lot of people to then reach out to us. People being able to share it with each other has encouraged a lot of people to send us, like, we get a ton of submissions, art, some letters to the editor, stuff like that from people who are incarcerated. So none of that would happen if we didn't have the physical magazine.
Awesome. So what is the future for Earth First? You have this crowdfunding campaign. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the office moving. What does this mean for the project?
Well, I think, first of all, just on why we want to move a little bit, the project has been in Florida for close to a decade. And throughout the journal's existence, it's moved fairly often. It was in Tucson, it was in Eugene, it was in Missoula for a little while. I probably don't even know all the places it's been. And it feels important. It's really part of the journal's character that it doesn't get stuck in one place or in the hands of one group of people, that it continues to move and be influenced by different people in different areas, different campaigns. So it seems like a good time to go. And also we're just, we're in the far southeast corner of the country, and I think it's hard for people to come out here. We haven't gotten as many volunteers lately. We want to be in a place that's a little more accessible to people, and in a place that maybe has a little bit more of a history of eco defense. I mean, when the journal came here, there was like a lot going on. South Florida has a lot of rad anarchists, a lot of people doing awesome work. There was a forest defense campaign here for a long time. But being somewhere where we can be really immersed again in just Earth First and environmental campaigns. So, yeah, and I think we'll also, like, if we're going to move to the Pacific Northwest, have some more opportunities for stuff on the money side of things, too. You know, tabling and all that nonsense. But, so we're trying to raise $23,000 so we can print the next couple issues of the magazine while moving. Because normally, like Onion mentioned earlier, we have donors, we have some fairly steady sources of income, but if we're going to be putting our energy into packing all our stuff up and moving, we're not necessarily going to have time to do that. So we want to make sure that we can not skip an issue of the journal when we move, if at all possible. And then obviously getting a van and all of the, whatever boring stuff, plastic crates for all of our thousands of magazines and stuff. So, we have information on our website right now. On our Facebook. I know I was just talking about Facebook being creepy. We need a ton of money.
Not too long ago, a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, the journal was really struggling. Like, we weren't coming out with issues consistently. People weren't getting paid. And we've spent the past few years just busting our asses trying to get back on track down here in Florida, where it's not always easy because it's hot. So now we're at the point where we come out with 4 issues a year. We've been doing that. This will be the 4th year in a row after we do it this year. We used to sell merchandise through a third party and almost every month end up owing money on it. And now we're making a fair amount of money on it. We used to distribute magazines to different stores and then never really get paid. And then we decided to make an effort to actually follow up on things and get money from stores. and that's been working out. So we were sailing along for a while, and then the hurricane last year kind of fucked us up. You know, like our house is barely standing, so we had to evacuate the house for the hurricane, and then we didn't have power for a week, and then we weren't able to come back right away. And so that set us behind. And then we had a couple of our bigger donors started having financial difficulties and stopped giving us money. So, or as much money. So that combination of things has kind of knocked us almost unconscious. So now we're just trying to crawl back up, come out with a couple issues and get out of Florida.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're going to be having, we launched this fundraiser. We sent out emails. It's on Facebook. It's on Twitter. I think it's on Tumblr. Whatever that is. And next we're going to be having some like merch deals, some deals on our merchandise. We're getting some books from AK Press that we're going to be giving away or selling. And then we're asking groups throughout the country to have fundraisers for us. I personally think that's where we're going to get most of the money from, is anybody who thinks the journal is cool, who read it and wants to see it continue, have a party, charge people $5, give us the money. It'll be very helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think as far as like what the future holds for the journal, like I touched on, reasons we want to move out there, like being in a more accessible location for people to come through and just stay for a little bit, volunteer, be here for a while. And we also hope to really like continue to deepen our connections with people who are in Earth First, with people who are incarcerated. And also a big priority of mine in the future is to really deepen our connection with other like radical media projects. You know, maybe the journal could get on other platforms. And I also think, yeah, being able to have like this conversation with you all and trying to continue to have communication feels really important to me, because I'm always really excited that like you all exist, and Unicorn Riot, and there's so many cool little tiny anarchist projects, and I would love to be in communication and figure out how to help each other be better.
Future is bright for the Earth First Journal.
Maybe.
Awesome. Well, just to kind of end on that note, the last question is just with everything going on. I know when we started, we were talking about the explosion that just happened near Lake Superior. I mean, just with everything going on, you know, what's giving you hope right now? I mean, because it's clear that climate change obviously is real. It's happening. But I mean, we're going to suffer through some drastic changes. And hopefully out of that, we can find a way past industrial civilization. But I'm just curious, like, what gives you hope for the future?
For me personally, it's as much as I'm disappointed in humanity, it's also certain people inspire me. You know, I know that the journal has been around for 40 years and has had hundreds of people come through and work. And like some people stayed for a few days, some people stayed for years, and they all sacrificed, and they moved around a lot. They did what they had to do. And now because of all those people doing that, and because of all the people in the Matoll and at Louis Levy and all these other different places, we have jobs to do. You know, like when I wake up in the morning and I check my email and I see people thanking us and people just like sending in short communiques from whatever they're doing. And I check it's going down and I see how much rad shit is going on and not just the environmental movement. And that makes me want to just keep on going.
For me, yeah, kind of like you were saying, seeing all the amazing things that people are doing around the world. And I think seeing that when shit gets really dire, people come together and come up with interesting ways to resist. Like, you know, my whole life I've had this, like, maybe I'll just read too much science fiction, but this, like, you envision like the apocalypse or the end of the world, and it's everybody's out for themselves, and like I don't know, it just feels like we're here, climate change is real, everything is incredibly dire, and people are reacting to it in really amazing, inspiring ways, and trying to create communities that can last, and trying to defend what wilderness is left, and yeah, just seeing all of that stuff happen, and especially in terms of, like, long-term communities, you know, like we talked about the Zod, like, places where people are really trying to have a different, create a real community and a different way of living while resisting every day. It's really inspiring to me. And all the international solidarity, and you see people, like, in the Zod and Rojava and Louisiana and Germany all, like, holding signs to each other, supporting each other. It feels, like, really amazing to be able to even know about all of these different struggles that are going on.
Awesome. Well, on that note, anything else you want to say? You know, I encourage people to check out the Earth First Journal Newswire, another great, you know, place to get news and information. And, you know, also get a subscription to the Earth First Journal. You know, you will not regret it. There's a lot of great stuff in there that doesn't come out online. There's information about how to write prisoners. There's, like, great columns and articles. It's a great resource. And if you can, get a bulk, you know, subscription and have it sent to some radical space, community center, bookstore, info shop, what have you. It's definitely an amazing resource to have.
I do want to add that, like we said earlier, people should submit stuff to us, write us, call us, send us an email. I mean, I think what's allowed the journal to exist as long as it has is that it has been shaped by so many people. So many different people contribute to it, and we really want to keep that going. So, like, please don't hesitate to send us your submissions to the magazine. If something's going on in your area and you can't write about it, let us know so we can figure out how to spread the word. Send us articles you think should be on the Newswire. Just tell us how you think we're doing. We really want to talk to people and to have people's voices in the journal and on our website.
Yeah, and it gets very lonely down here in South Florida. Nobody comes to visit hardly. So even a note saying, like, oh, I like that one article you shared, or
I hated it.
Yeah, you suck. Your magazine's anything. We just need people to talk to besides ourselves. And it would be great if people could give us money at earthfirstjournal.org/donate. Or buy some merch at earthfirstjournal.org/store. Even get a lifetime sub. It's only $500.
but you get it for your entire life.
Or the life of the journal, whichever comes last. First. And I think another important thing to say is that it would be great if someone did what you said and bought a bulk subscription and sent it to a rad place. But also if you're in a rad collective house or you go to a lot of shows or you're part of a campaign or something, but you don't have the money for magazines, let us know and we can figure out a way to send you 5, 10, 50 magazines. But if you do have the money, give it to us, because that's what allows us to give away free magazines.
All right, y'all. Thanks so much for joining us, and best of luck to you with the move.
Thanks.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.